Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Face. We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics. And there's always a message involved.
You're listening to Radio Basics, the radio wing of Basics Community News Service. Bringing news from the people to the people on CHRY on 5.5 FM.
What up, Toronto? This is Kirti from Radio Basics. Another Monday, exciting Monday.
What's going on, Kirti? This is Steve in the studio. It's been like 6 weeks. It's good to be back.
It definitely does.
I didn't really go anywhere, but you know, our team is growing, expanding. So
I know.
Getting fresh blood, you know, take it up.
Yeah, different voices, different perspectives, mm-hmm. and we're all here.
Well, same perspective. You know, it's the people, the struggles of the people.
Different ways of getting there.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, let's compromise.
So what do we got on the show today?
We have an exciting interview from Gaza, from a doctor who was actually there during the latest attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have headlines, which you prepared.
Definitely, headlines, mm-hmm. and later in the show, this is also December 3rd, the International Day in Support of Political Prisoners.
That's right.
And we're going to be talking a bit about that at the end of the show.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
But before that, headline news?
Yes, go for it.
All right, in local news, dozens of people braved the cold and wet temperatures yesterday to turn out to a rally at Queen's Park to participate in prayer, song, ceremony, and poems in solidarity with the longest-running blockade in Ontario, the 10-year blockade of the Anishinaabe community of Grassy Narrows, Ontario, almost 24 hours north of Toronto. The blockade began in protest of large-scale clear-cutting on First Nations land. On December 2nd, 2002, two young Anishinaabekwe went out in the snow and frigid temperatures to start what is now the longest-running blockade on Turtle Island, the name that many Indigenous nations have for North America. Today, in Kenora, Ontario, Grassy Narrows protesters marched in front of the Weyerhaeuser, in front of the Weyerhaeuser company, to show the logging industry that they are still present and that they oppose all logging on their territory. Also in local news, Mayor Ford will stay in the mayor's seat at least until his appeal is heard. Today, the claimant, Paul Magner, who brought the conflict of interest case against Ford, agreed to allow for a stay of the decision that Ford must leave office within 2 weeks of Judge Hackland's ruling last week. Meanwhile, the rest of Toronto, love Ford or hate him, are scratching their heads wondering how a mayor can be ordered out of office by a member of the judiciary and then allowed to stay longer in office by the whim of a claimant who said today, quote, "We are agreeing to this stay to give the City of Toronto a measure of stability, something that has been wholly absent during Ford's term in office." So he wants to stabilize Toronto by keeping the mayor, who is destabilized Toronto, in office. Okay. All right. Moving on. Bridging local and federal news here. Last week, on Wednesday, November 28th, a few hundred protesters gathered at Queen's Park in direct opposition to the federal private members' bill C-428, known as an act to amend the Indian Act and to provide for its replacement. The Union of Ontario Indians, a leader of the Union of Ontario Indians, Patrick Madabi, and Isaac Day were in attendance and spoke out in opposition to the private members' bill. Hundreds of protesters took to the streets and marched down University Avenue during rush hour to the Westin Hotel, where they stormed the Union of Ontario Indians chiefs meeting and demanded to be heard. Upon arrival, they were warmly welcomed, and an honor song was sung to pay tribute to the grassroots organizers and protesters. The next plan of action is set for December 21st, 2012, at Parliament Hill in Ottawa. Richard Peters, also known as Gabwanese, or Red-Tailed Hawk, one of the founders of the Oshkamadzik Reclamation Site in Owenda Provincial Park, told BasicsNews.ca today that, quote, "What few rights exist in the Indian Act would be extinguished by this piece of legislation, and furthermore, this legislation is being advanced with no consultation with people affected by the Indian Act." In federal news, the federal government is refusing to hand over documents detailing the treatment of the forcefully assimilated Native children in Canada's residential schools. The commission examining the treatment of Aboriginal children at Canada's residential schools is taking the federal government to court for refusing to release millions of documents that were supposed to form a permanent and public record of the abuses committed. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, established in 2008 as part of the settlement between former students, the Canadian government, and the churches that ran the schools, has asked an Ontario Superior Court judge to decide whether Canada is obligated to hand over the material. Prime Minister Stephen Harper issued an apology in 2008 for the forced assimilation of hundreds of thousands of Indigenous children, which many First Nations communities found utterly insulting, given the long-lasting trauma and damage inflicted by those schools on First Nations. The federal government's lack of compliance is suggesting a guilty conscience, not at all ready or willing to arrive at genuine truth and reconciliation. In international news, Venezuela to host the first Palestinian diplomatic mission. Venezuela will be the first country to receive an official Palestinian delegation after the Middle Eastern country was recognized by the United Nations as a non-member observer state last Thursday. The UN General Assembly overwhelmingly voted to grant Palestine's request for an observer status, state status. This despite opposition from certain predictable imperialist and Zionist supporting countries, including Canada, the United States, and of course Israel itself. The United Nations vote comes just a week after the end of Israel's latest military assault on Palestine's Gaza Strip, which left 162 Palestinians dead and five Israelis. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez publicly condemned the attacks as savage at the time. Yesterday, a Palestinian delegation arrived in Venezuela to discuss eight new accords in the areas of health, education, tourism, culture, sport, and more. Palestinian ambassador to Venezuela, Farid Sawan, added that existing agreements between Venezuela and Palestine will also be strengthened, including scholarship programs for Palestinians to study in Venezuela. Venezuela established diplomatic relations with Palestine back in April 2009 after severing relations with Israel in reaction to its January 2009 assault on the Gaza Strip. In more news from occupied Palestine, Israel has once again decided to show contempt towards the fundamental rights of Palestinians in particular and the international community in general. Israel has revealed plans to build 3,000 new settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. This would effectively cut the occupied West Bank in two, north and south, and sever it from Jerusalem, making the creation of a viable Palestinian state impossible. Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs succinctly declared on Twitter today that, quote, Israeli construction on Palestinian territories occupied in 1967 is illegal, unrecognized, and condemned by Russia and internationally. Even close allies of Israel condemned the move, with France and England considering recalling their diplomats from Israel as a censure. Meanwhile, Canada stood alone in the world in supporting Israel and continuing its strong backing of the Zionist state. Now to occupied Tamil Ilam. Jaffna University students boycotted classes last Wednesday and peacefully rallied in front of the university entrance, protesting the Sri Lankan military's brutal attack on a peaceful student march commemorating Tamil freedom fighters the day before on November 27th, just a little over 3 years after the Sri Lankan government conducted its genocide of Tamils on the island, killing upwards in around 100,000 people. Following the Sri Lankan army attack last week, protesting students started to throw stones, demanding immediate release of four detained students, with 10 more students sustaining injuries. Jaffna student leaders were urging international solidarity as peaceful Tamil protests are brutally suppressed by the Sri Lankan government. The occupying military of Sri Lanka approached the University of Jaffna administration to threaten them not to take up the issue of arrested students. The university remains vacated as student leaders are being forced into hiding. A protest demonstration by the medical faculty of the university scheduled for today was cancelled in fear of lives for detained students. Various campuses and organizations will be organizing solidarity rallies in support of the Jaffna University Students' Union. And here on York University campus, where CHRY 105.5 is based out of, a rally will be held tomorrow at 2 p.m. in Very Hall in support of the Tamil students at Jaffna University. And the demands, I believe, for the rally include the immediate release of four of the students, Paralingam, Tarsanant, Ganesamurthy Sudarsan, Sanmugan Salomon, and one other student. The Sri Lankan state cease all intimidation against Jaffna University students and immediately cease all forms of oppressive and genocidal colonization of the Tamil homeland. And I think that's all we got for headlines today, Kirti. I know Are we moving into commercials?
We're going to quickly move into commercials and be right back.
All right.
This is CHRO 105.5 FM.
So we're back on Radio Basics, and up next we have an interview. So like I mentioned earlier during the show, I had the opportunity to actually interview a doctor who was from Canada, who went to Gaza for a brief time frame, and was able to actually witness some of the atrocities that was happening there. And it's basically, you know, we're just going to explore what exactly you saw and just gain a perspective on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
All right, let's do that.
This is Kirti from Radio Basics, and I'm here today with Chris. And Chris was in Gaza a couple of weeks ago. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, so Chris, can you just start off by discussing why you were there and just the kind of work you do?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a family doctor by training, pursuing a post grad fellowship in emergency medicine. And I was very lucky to be able to participate in a delegation of healthcare professionals that went to Gaza to teach a course called Advanced Cardiac Life Support, which is pretty standard amongst hospital-based practitioners in Canada. But because of the kind of isolation due to the Israeli blockade on Gaza, amongst other factors, this course had not been widely rolled out in Gaza.
Why did you feel that it was important to go to Gaza?
Well, basically, the situation in Gaza, I'm sure we'll get into this in more detail, but as you know, since 2006, when Hamas came to power in free and fair democratic elections, and after the attempted coup by Fatah and the response to that by Hamas, where they ended up taking over authority in Gaza, there was a blockade and a siege which was put on Gaza, supported by Canada, basically from day one. And so before that time, Israeli human rights organizations like Physicians for Human Rights Israel had done some good work in terms of ensuring that Palestinians could have access to healthcare within Israel. It was a bit of a double-edged sword because it did hit at capacity within Gaza and within Palestine to provide critical care services to their population. And when the siege came into full effect, many Palestinian patients were no longer able to get into Israel for complex treatments like dialysis or for critical care situations. And the capacity wasn't on the ground. It was underdeveloped because of that previous dependence on Israel. And I think Palestinians within the Ministry of Health realized that was a shortcoming. It needed to be overcome by building local capacity, not having to rely on the Israelis for that.
Okay, so the people of Gaza are locked in, and they have no control over their airspace, their borders, trade, or just the quality of life to begin with, right? So I'm guessing this is where a project like yours comes into play. But going even back, how did people start responding and resisting this blockade and just the situation in general that they're that's been imposed on them?
Mm. Well, I mean, it comes out of a tradition of resistance. You know, Palestinians have been resisting Israeli occupation since 1948, so there's a long, long history in place and a lot of ingenuity that comes into play, a lot of made-in-Palestine type solutions. Mm. So, you know, during this time of blockade, a number of strategies have come into play. Mm-hmm. There used to be a large metal barrier fence between the southern portion of Gaza and Egypt, mm-hmm. Which was sort of co-patrolled by Israel. And during a particularly tight time in the blockade, when the Gazan people were suffering a lot, the resistance managed to blow up, knock over a very large portion of this, you know, solid steel fence, and, you know, thousands of people streamed across into Egypt and, you know, got supplies and things like that. So that was one example of some of the ingenuity and solutions that have come up under the pressure that's been put on by the blockade. The other is the tunnels, and this is pretty phenomenal. The degree engineering sophistication. There's a ministry of tunnels, inspectors, engineers that certify tunnels for different purposes, transport of goods. You know, there's special tunnels that people can go through that are ventilated. I never saw the tunnels. This is hearsay from some people that I spoke with, but it just goes to show that, you know, even under almost impossible circumstances, the Palestinians have been pretty remarkable in finding ways to resist and overcome some of the obstacles.
And how are people surviving out there? Like, how? What did their daily life look like? At least before the bombardment started.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard for me to provide any broad sweeps of analysis here, having been there so briefly and been in contact with mostly health professionals. You know, from what I saw and from the people I spoke with, life's a struggle. 80% of the population of Gaza are actually refugees from what is now Israel. And a lot of them are living in incredibly cramped conditions in refugee camps. So, you know, life's difficult from that regard, from cramped housing. Gaza's got one of the highest fertility rates in the world, so the population is very young. 50% of the population is under the age of 18.
Wow.
So when you hear about civilian casualties, you know, odds are that they're mostly going to be children, or at least half will be children, and that's consistent with what I ended up seeing just in the very first Israeli bombardment. But as you're saying, you know, just for people to understand what the siege means, basically there's Israeli gunboats patrolling, which don't allow fishermen beyond 3 miles of the territorial waters of Gaza. So under international law, they have the right to go up 20 miles to do fishing and that sort of thing, but Israeli gunboats will fire on fishermen who venture out past the 3 mile limit. Also, there's a 300 meter kill zone on the Gazan side of the Israeli border fence. Anyone venturing within 300 meters of the fence is open game to be shot at. Mm-hmm. And even after the ceasefire, I think you might have heard about the one person who was killed and the 19 injured when they ventured out into that quote unquote no go zone to you know, to test the conditions, because part of the ceasefire conditions was that Israel would lift the siege. So that accounts for 17% of the Gaza territory is inaccessible. 35% of the arable farmland, because the farmland is generally along the border fence, is not accessible. So you have a population that's under a lot of food stress. You have a lot of children who are stunted in terms of their growth. You know, there was recently a leaked report that was acquired through an access to information request by an Israeli NGO, which revealed that Israeli technocrats actually calculate the caloric intake needed to keep people just above starvation, and were basically using that as a means to decide how many trucks of food to allow into Gaza. Israel is the occupying power and therefore has responsibility for the well-being of that population. And, you know, the siege is definitely something which is, you know, detrimental to the day-to-day lives and health of the Palestinian people.
So how are women being affected by these conditions?
Most families in Gaza are quite large. A friend of mine was one of 18 children. I said, you know, allowing a mother must have it hard, and she's like, no, I have it hard, because, you know, she's involved in raising all of her younger siblings as well, while, you know, working full-time as a midwife. She was a pretty spectacular person. But, you know, any time that you have conditions of war or hardship, it's going to, I think, hit women particularly hard, being often the caregivers and within a society. You know, I think that the burden is felt particularly hard in that regard. I have to say that, you know, there's a lot of discourse around sexism within the Muslim world, and you know, sexism looks different in different parts of the world.
Definitely.
You know, Canadian society is quite sexist in a lot of ways. You know, some impressive things were the head of interventional cardiology in Gaza was a woman. There are many, many female doctors in high positions. So that was something that I think was surprising to some members of our delegation, seeing that there are a lot of Palestinian women in high positions within at least the healthcare institutions that we were involved in.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier that 50% of the population there are quite young.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of curious to know what kind of role they play in Gaza at this point in time and what they feel that's expected out of them, from what you understand.
From what I understand, it's a pretty dire situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are kids that have grown up under incredibly traumatic and stressful conditions. It's every... every few years there's often a major assault. You might remember the 2008-2009 war on Gaza, where 1,500 people were killed and many more thousands injured, and a huge amount of housing and infrastructure important for a society to survive, like their water treatment or power plants were also knocked out. So and this is not something that just happens every few years. Every few days there's someone getting killed along the border fence or these kind of things. So the pressure is constant. And then there's also not a lot of hope within Gaza. The siege really has hurt the economy a lot. They're not able to export goods there, which means that there's not a lot of local industry employing people. And people have been largely forbidden from leaving the area. And so there's a real... a lot of people have lost hope, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, there's a fair amount of problems with drug use amongst the youth there, just because there's very little hope for what they can make of their lives. There's, as I say, just a huge number of young people and mm-hmm. very few opportunities available. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously, it is a really dire situation that they're in, but I was kind of curious to know, how are they resisting? How are they showing signs of resistance? Or what did you see?
Mm-hmm.
As signs of resistance there?
I would say, again, having been there very briefly and had contact with mostly people involved in the health fields, just carrying out their day-to-day functions, I think, is an act of resistance. Obviously, there's an active armed resistance with which I didn't have any contact, but there's that avenue. There's... just people carrying on with their lives, people who are, for example, the paramedics that I met who, are often fired upon. There were cases in the 2008-2009 where experimental weapons were used against ambulances that were going to pick up the injured during the war who were targeted. So, there's an incredible amount of courage shown by those folks in particular. But really just continuing to exist, having resisted ethnic cleansing for so many years, I think, is an act of resistance in and of itself.
Definitely,
probably here, Indigenous people in Canada say mm-hmm. the same thing. That
for sure,
just being here is an ongoing form of resistance.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So Gaza has been under blockade since 2006. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg there. But how this affected your work there, the blockade itself, or just in terms of health? And health services.
Yeah, so just getting to Gaza has been something which has been very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And, the fact that we could get in through the Egyptian border is the product of a lot of struggles. So, there have been many unsuccessful attempts to break the blockade by sea. Mm-hmm. You might remember the Mavi Marmara.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a Turkish vessel and part of a larger flotilla that was attempting to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza and was violently attacked in international waters by Israeli naval commandos. I think some 9 people were killed in that. But, those efforts definitely did result in some easing of the blockade, the sacrifice that those people made by standing up and resisting did have tangible impacts in terms of a slight ease of the siege. Of course, the Egyptian revolution and the overthrow of Mubarak did lead to greater easing of the border, which had been fairly hermetically sealed by Mubarak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was really the factor that allowed us to get into Gaza, which was good. In terms of how the siege impacted our work,
mm-hmm.
we had to bring some equipment in, which luckily was able to get across the border. But I think it's more in terms of how it affects and has affected the broader medical services within Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
A dynamic I was pointing out before where I think a lot of services had gone underdeveloped because of reliance on Israeli health services, which were then suddenly cut off when the siege really came into effect in 2006.
So there was a huge cutback on what was provided in terms of medical care as well, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how are you trying to compensate for that, or how are they managing?
Yeah, I mean, so they're building their own local capacity in terms of, you know, dialysis machines, and people trained to use them, you know, for people in kidney failure who are formerly treated in Israel. And, you know, efforts like the one I was a part of where there are international agreements, cooperation agreements to help build training programs to train healthcare workers proficient in certain areas like that of emergency medicine or critical care, which you know, which were in really in need of development and you know, really strained heavily by just the enormous amount of casualties that came in during the attacks, which started while I was there and continued after I left.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the attacks, so I was going to ask you about that next. So can you just paint that picture for us? What exactly happened maybe the day before to the day of, till the day you left, kind of thing?
Sure, so there'd been a series of activities along the border fence, which, as describing before, there's mm-hmm. this kind of 300-meter kill zone in which Israeli soldiers will fire upon Palestinians who venture into this area or who are debatably on the edge of this area, which isn't, you know, it's not flagged by neon tape or anything.
Yes.
And there's regular incursions by Israeli forces into Gaza. And in one of these incursions, a cognitively challenged young man had been killed. On another incursion, a 13-year-old child playing soccer was shot in the head.
Mm.
And the resistance within Gaza had responded by stepping up attacks on Israeli soldiers patrolling that border fence. Mm-hmm. So there'd been an explosion, some explosive placed in a tunnel under the border, which targeted a patrol, and then on the day of the shelling, there was an Israeli convoy which was targeted by an anti-tank missile fired by the Palestinian resistance. So these were attacks by the Palestinian resistance on military targets. And under international law, under occupation, the occupied had a right to resist.
Mm-hmm.
And these were attacks upon uniformed Israeli soldiers. Basically, what seems to have happened is after the attack on the convoy, The Israelis began shelling the area from which the attack had happened, and this resulted in some people being wounded, and then there was a funeral nearby where many members of the funeral rushed to help the person who had been wounded, and they got hit by the next shell that came in.
Mm.
So these were mostly young people. The youngest I saw was probably 6 years old. It was a few 12-year-olds, 17- and 8-year-old brother that were killed. But in any case, it hit really close to home because one of the members of our delegation was from the neighborhood which was shelled. And we were actually supposed to have dinner with his family that night. We'd been invited to their house for dinner. And as we were making preparations to leave and finishing up the course for the day, we received news that there was a mass casualty incident.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically is medical speak for just the resources being overwhelmed by, you know, a situation which, you know, the hospital would be unable to cope with under regular circumstances. And so we were asked to assist in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the main trauma hospital, Al-Shifa Hospital, is the main trauma hospital in all of Gaza. But even its capacities were totally overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
We had between 25 and 30 patients showing up with severe injuries all at once, like within the course of 5 to 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really chaotic and scary, and we had limited resources to figure out who needed to go immediately to the operating room to have surgery, who could be saved, who couldn't, who it was worth putting the efforts into saving, and who was not saved or salvageable at that point. As a medical professional, you go into a bit of autopilot. You're not necessarily emotionally processing everything you're seeing.
You can't, right?
Yeah, you can't do that in function, right? And that's part of medical training, is this gradual desensitization which occurs, which, has some good aspects and has some negative aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And even just talking about it now, I start to process it a bit more emotionally because I'm out of the situation. But it was different than what I'd seen before. But to see something which was like a highly technological, mechanized device designed to mm-hmm. produce the most casualties possible, this was an intentional thing, something that had, engineers with PhDs designing, and seeing the results on human flesh was really, really traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
The night after that initial wave of casualties had come in, we went back to sleep in the hospital to be sort of on call to be ready to respond should there be another major shelling and mass casualty incident. And we actually ended up sleeping on the floor of the trauma resuscitation bay. And I was sleeping on a part of the floor that had been covered in the blood of a 17-year-old kid that we'd been trying to resuscitate earlier that day. And all the smells, the smell of blood, the smell of iodine, the whole environment, it was I'll never forget it.
Mm-hmm.
The Palestinians have been betrayed and abandoned by a lot of people over the years, and we really felt that it was incumbent upon us to show our solidarity by staying after the shelling and completing the course. So we stuck to our schedule and finished the course the next day. And many of the participants in the course had been, with us responding to this catastrophe,
mm-hmm.
Up all night treating the victims, and, were there eagerly to teach the course on the final day. And a really beautiful thing about the course was that we actually trained instructors who actually ended up running the final iteration of the course. So the last mm-hmm. iteration of the course was Palestinian run entirely. It was pretty remarkable. This word resilience comes up a lot, but
mm-hmm.
People's capacity to function under stress, like this midwife I talked about before, she'd had to work a night shift the night of the shelling, and she told me that the Israeli army will often send out text messages to people saying, get out of the building you're in because we're about to vomit. And mm-hmm. she was working in the main maternity hospital in Rafah, and they'd actually received a message that the hospital was going to be bombed, and so they had to evacuate patients. And in the end, it wasn't bombed, but and she was there the next day having only slept a couple mm-hmm. hours, mm-hmm. and she was one of the instructors teaching the course, mm-hmm. and so it was just people's determination to carry on with their lives was really remarkable. And I think that speaks to that earlier question you had about resistance, just mm-hmm. people carrying on. Obviously, things got more intense after I left. The pace of the airstrikes picked up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of residential buildings were targeted and flattened, and there were many, many casualties from that. So I can't speak to, how long that degree of normalcy continued. Like, the shops stayed open while I was there. People sort of very much carried on with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, after I left, things did get a lot more intense.
Mm-hmm. So despite all the attacks on them, they still, try to make everything function on a daily basis, and so shutting down and just hiding, right? It just seems to be what you're telling me right now.
I wasn't a participant. I didn't see sort of the mental health care mm-hmm. within Gaza, and I'm sure there's people that, are pushed beyond their limits in which they can cope and break down in that way, but people, it's not really an option. People have a lot of responsibilities as big families. You've mm-hmm. got to take care of each other and take care of neighbors who might have lost family members and things like that.
Now, one more thing. I was just kind of curious to know if you are in touch with anybody
mm-hmm.
on the ground there right now. Or have you heard back from anybody in regards to what's
yeah.
going on?
Yeah, no. One of the members in our delegation stayed behind during the rest of the attacks and mm-hmm. left after the ceasefire, so we got a lot of updates from him, and things intensified a lot. There were you know, what we saw was really the tip of the iceberg. There were countless other mass casualty incidents where many, many more victims came in grievously wounded and really kind of overwhelmed the capacity of the services that were available. You know, and he kept us up to date on, you know, just the numbers. And you know, people, I think, focus a lot on the numbers of dead, but, you know, in a place like Gaza that's blockaded, it's not exactly an easy place to live as a disabled person with disabilities. So there's a kind of a real double tragedy there in terms of, you know, the people that are left crippled by these attacks. And he shone a bit of a light on that. And, you know, I made some really, it was a short time, but I made some good friends there. Some of the health workers that I was involved in training, who I'm in touch with still, and keep me updated a bit on the situation. So, you know, there's been a ceasefire that's been declared, and some of the conditions for that are an easing of the blockade and the siege. So there have been, you know, through the sacrifice of the Palestinian people in Gaza, there were some things that were achieved in that. Palestinian fishermen are now being allowed out 6 miles so they can be more productive with their fishing. You know, there's been some confusion about the kill zone around the Israeli border fence, where Israeli soldiers will shoot on people within 300 meters of the fence, but it sounds like farmers are pushing the boundaries and accessing those areas, often at a great cost. There were a few people that were killed and many injured in one episode where people attempted to approach the, you know, still on Palestinian land on the Gazan side of the fence, approach the fence where they were shot at. But it sounds like, you know, some of the sacrifices that were made have led to some concrete changes on the ground and some easing of the blockade and the siege, but there's obviously so much more to be done. There's the issue of, you know, 80% of the population are refugees, and you know, they have a right to return to the land that they're ethnically cleansed from, which is now Israel. You know, this is not, we often, you know, hear about, in terms of media cycles, you know, a conflict comes up and we think about it in terms of days and weeks, but you know, what lies at the basis of this conflict is the fact that when the Israeli state came into being, it had a plan to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from what would become, quote-unquote, the Jewish state. And so you have a very well-documented case of ethnic cleansing where people, you know, there's 6 million Palestinian refugees who, you know, live in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and internally displaced refugees living in the West Bank and Gaza, who, you know, still hold the keys to the houses that they were forced from. And, you know, under international law, have a right to return to their houses in those places. And so we just heard in the news that in retaliation to Palestine gaining non-member observer status at the UN, that Israel has approved 3,000 new units to be built on Palestinian land in the West Bank. And Israel's really shooting themselves in the foot in terms of there's not a possibility now for a two-state solution. The West Bank is so segmented by Israeli settlements and checkpoints and, you know, Israeli-only roads, etc., that there's really no possibility for a viable Palestinian state. And so what this leads to is the question of, you know, a one-state solution, which becomes a civil rights struggle where, you know, Palestinians will be you know, and are articulating that they're living in an apartheid state, and, you know, hopefully a civil rights struggle similar to that which occurred in the United States or in apartheid South Africa can occur where you know, these conditions can be overcome and people can live in a just peace where, you know, there's equal opportunities for everyone regardless of their race within the land of historic Palestine. But no, it's a question of when that's going to happen, but I believe it's looking like it's heading there.
Thank you very much for joining Radio Basics today.
It's great to process and speak about some of the things that I saw. Thank you for having me.
So that was Chris, Dr. Chris, and he was in Gaza, and he does not want to disclose his last name for
Obvious reasons.
Yeah, obvious
right?
reasons. Yes.
He's a Toronto doctor who spent time in Gaza, as you were hearing there, just before too, and during the opening days of the most recent bombing campaign of Gaza by Israel. And here we are a week later, with Palestine having received observer status, non-member status at the United Nations, as we talked about in the headlines. It's diplomatic missions beginning to develop throughout the world. You know, Venezuela being a country that was very quite enthusiastic about receiving and working with Palestine, and also news. In the last couple of days that Israel is planning to build a settlement that cuts through West Bank, which will divide it and break it as a contiguous territory, break it into a north and a south, and separate it from East Jerusalem, thereby making the possibility of a viable united Palestinian state on what land is left, what land has not been stolen, quite impossible.
Yeah, more challenging.
And Canada, being, I think, the only country in the world, because even the U.S. and a number of European states, including France, has threatened to withdraw their ambassadors. Canada, even the United States, you know, surprisingly, denounced Israel in this question of the settlement. Canada was the only country in the world, I believe, that actually unabashedly supported the Zionist settlement and occupation of Palestine.
All right, so now we're going to go for a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Your community radio,
CHRY
105.5.
Okay, so we're back on Radio Basics, and we're just going to start off with some poems, right?
Well, yeah, today is December 3rd, the International Day for Solidarity with Political Prisoners. And our own organization, Basics Community News Service, along with many of our allies from around the world in the International League of People Struggles, are going to be participating in a reading of two poems in solidarity with political prisoners around the world that were written by Filipino political prisoners and prisoners of war. Just a couple weeks ago at the second General Assembly of ILPS Canada, International League of People Struggles Canada, our organization, along with, you know, about a two dozen other ally organizations from across the country, passed a resolution to step up our support for political prisoners, knowing well that as more and more people throughout the world resist policies of imperialist globalization and war and occupation and environmental plunder and destruction and austerity measures in this, you know, age of capitalist crisis and decline, that more and more of us will be targeted for our political work and activism and organizing and mobilizing. And so at that assembly, that, you know, where all these people's organizations came together, we vowed to especially focus on the hundreds of Filipino activists who are prisoners of war, incarcerated for their resistance and their organizing in the streets and among the people, to the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails, as well as to recognize that the indigenous people incarcerated in this country, who make up approximately one quarter of all prisoners in Canada, even though they're less than 5% of the population, to recognize that as political as well, and to begin advocating for political prisoners. And we said that December 3rd will be the day that we kicked off this campaign that we'll be developing in the coming months and years. The following two poems come to us from the Philippines and have been translated into English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Russian, and Chinese, and are being read all across the world today. The first one is called Political Prisoner's Song. My wall is not only cold and unkempt, framed on it is the welt mark of torment. My floor is not only dirty and roughly done, laid on it is my sick boredom. My prison bars do not only have rust for scabs, crusting on it are wounds of longed for freedom. Wash with the salve of poems the wounds of freedom. Bash, bash down the smooth bars of prison. Smash, smash down the pestilence of oppression. Rise, rise up in the night with raging light. Break, break down the walls of repression. Fight, fight back incarceration with cries of emancipation. That was Political Prisoner's Song, in honor and recognition of political prisoners all around the world on this day, International Day for Solidarity with Political Prisoners. And I know Kirti will also be reading another poem.
Yeah. This one is called The Political Detainee, and it's a translation by Ryan Fuentes. My prison walls, more than cold and sticky, are framing whips of twisting agony. My floor isn't only rough and dirty, in it is trapped a searing ennui. The iron bars coated with rust, the freedom I so want has greased its crust. Smear with verses and slippery freedom, tear and tear down the silken wrought iron, shut and shut off the plague's kingdom. Rise from the darkness lighted by anguish, smash and smash the walls of cowardice, smash the coral with the cry of release. So, yeah, those are really powerful poems there. And I'm glad that I actually had the opportunity to be one of the people reading that out today.
Mm-hmm. And I also have another little surprise. I don't even know if you've heard this one yet.
Okay.
But if you toss me that auxiliary cable there, this is also in honor of, probably what is the world's most well-known political prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just listen to it and we'll comment after.
Okay,
check this
sounds
out.
Good.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM Toronto, Radio Basics, People's Media. Since 2008, CHRY, where the campus meets the community. So hold on to this precious resource. For Radio Basics, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal from Imprisoned Nation, USA.
That's right, Mumia Abu-Jamal, probably the world's most well-known political prisoner,
mm-hmm.
Former Black Panther Party member, a journalist, one of the most prolific voices from behind bars, mm-hmm. Known throughout the world, probably the world's most supported and well-known political prisoner. Doing a stinger for Radio Basics in solidarity People's Media, behind enemy lines, and, in front of enemy lines.
That's
so
big.
Much respect to Mumia for the shout out of solidarity to Radio Basics.
Yes.
I think we're going to move on to community announcements now.
Yes, we have a couple of things that are happening around the city. So I'm just going to start off with the one that's closest to us, I would say, in terms of date. So there is an event on Thursday. It's a boycott launch against non-union Novotel hotels in Ontario. A lot of you might know Novotel. It's a French based chain of hotels around the world, and the workers are actually trying to unionize, and they're going to start off by boycotting the hotel itself because there's been a lot of attacks on workers. So you should definitely check that out if you have time on Thursday at 10 a.m. It's at 2 Bloor Street East, and that's right in front of the French consulate, which is Yonge and Bloor Northeast Corner. So you should definitely take some time to check that out if you're not doing anything on Thursday. Another thing that's coming up is on Sunday, December the 9th. It's called Celebrating People's Resistance, Forging Solidarity in the Struggle for Human Rights. And that's, again, on Sunday, December the 9th from 3 to 8 p.m. It's held at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, Bloor Street, and Spadina.
And it's linking in with some of the issues we've been talking
mm-hmm,
tonight. I know
exactly.
We have speakers talking on Palestine, Philippines, Tamililam,
Latino struggle. Yeah. So, and that again is from 3 to 8. From 3 to 6, it's basically, a series of information tables, speaker panel and discussions. And then from 6 to 8, it's culture, performance, and the social. So you definitely should check that out on December the 9th. You had one more for us, right? An event?
Yes, actually, we have one of our fellow Radio Basics members on the line with us, Camila Uribe. How are you, sister?
Hey, I'm good. How's it going?
Good. I think you wanted to contribute an event from remotely, from where you are.
Yeah, I'm actually, we're preparing for our event on Wednesday night. We're rehearsing our theater play, just to tell everyone what's going on. I'm working with the Hispanic Tenants Association Social Housing, and we're preparing a play that focuses on issues relevant to Latinos, to seniors, and basically everyone in social housing. So the play this year is about hoarding. I don't know what that is, if you guys have heard about it, but apparently it's a really big issue.
It is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was even like a headline a few weeks ago, the Sun, Toronto Sun, the headline was Hoarding Horror.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's, I think there's even a TV show and stuff where, you know, this is talked about. But the idea through this play is to open up a space where this can be talked about without, you know, these negative prejudices.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes, yes, without stigma, I was saying.
Yeah, without stigma, exactly. Because, you know, even the fact that headline that says Hoarding Horror gives the people who suffer from this problem, you know, it stigmatizes them. And then we have to be aware that this is a psychological problem, but it's also associated with a lot of social and cultural factors, which is what the seniors that I'm working with right now want to talk about with in their play, you know, things like immigration, isolation,
poverty.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we live in a society that tells us to accumulate, mm-hmm. accumulate.
Exactly.
And so consumers.
This is, I mean, this is just an expression of...
And it's being presented by seniors?
Yes, all the actors are seniors.
Nice.
They're all Latino seniors. The play will be in Spanish, but there will be interpretation provided.
Sweet.
So this is happening at Palmerston Library on Wednesday night at 6:30. So, and it's free of charge, of course, since this is a non-for-profit thing. So, you know, it would be awesome to have everyone come out or whoever's interested in this. So, you know, the idea is to have the theater as a starting point for this to like a debate or a discussion to continue and hopefully some advances can be made on this and other issues that affect people in social housing.
Thank you very much for the announcement.
I'll
be checking it out.
And yeah, we should get that up on the basicsnews.ca website if it's not already there.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a good point. Anyway, yeah, thanks, guys.
All right, Camila. When's your next radio show? When can our audience expect to have you back?
I think it's the 17th that I'm
back
for
sure. We'll tune in.
Sounds good.
Take care, sister.
All right. Peace.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye, guys. Take care.
And I believe that's all we got for tonight.
One more reminder about tomorrow, the Tamil Students Association.
That's right, Tamil Students Association here on York University campus is holding a rally in Verey Hall on campus at 2 p.m. in support of the students at Jaffna University who have been arrested and who are coming under repression by the Sri Lankan state.
And is that all?
That's all we got for today.
Beautiful.
Radio Basics, you're listening to one of the voices of the people, I think. You know, we want to see lots
of
like Radio Basics as NCHRY as institutions. You know, and definitely we need way more voices of the people out there commanding the airwaves, hijacking the station, the TV stations, and just, you know,
taking
from
advantage
the people
of space.
To the people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, and also I'll keep on saying this every time I'm on the show. Anytime you want to give us some feedback, show us some love, criticisms. You know, if you want us to even check out a certain issue that's happening in your neighborhood that's so close to your heart. Exactly, holla.
Yeah.
And the email is radiobasics@gmail.com. And if you're an artist who wants us to play your music on the air, obviously there's going to be some, you know, we always... We will check it out before we play it. But if you want us to do that, that's also something that we're definitely open to.
And to go out, you know, this we've been hearing all across the headlines today the most dominant story of all the things happening in this world. You know, every news station that I turned to gather some of the material for today's show, the headline story was the announcement that Prince William and the Duchess of Cambridge, Catherine, will be having or expecting a baby. And this baby, of course, the third in line to inherit the bloodline to the, you know, the British throne.
And have their face on our currencies.
Yeah. and that's the least of the evils.